I'm Dr. Dan Twelker. I'm here with Bill Carter in Bisbee. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm really good.
Good. It was a beautiful drive down here yesterday.
Oh, yeah. It's fabulous.
Crystalline clear skies, crisp, cool weather.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed coming down.
Have you ever read Going Back to Bisbee?
Yes. Yes.
That drive.
That is that. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Every time I come back and I hit the beginning of that canyon, which is about 8 miles, I'm in love again every single time I do it, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I love it down here.
And then once here, I love the older buildings, the architecture, the narrow streets.
Yeah.
The type of towns that you could tell they were built back before
strip malls
and lots of cars and, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I come from a small town, so I lived in Tucson. I love Tucson, but I'm very comfortable in smaller towns. One, because I like walking. It's a big thing.
Yeah.
And Tucson's pretty difficult to walk. You can walk around your little area, but to get anything, you have to drive.
Yeah.
So that's just something I don't do well with, you know? Mm-hmm. So
You grew up in California, right?
Right.
And I know from your book, Fools Rush In, that you lived in Alaska for a while.
Right.
And worked in Alaska. And you've lived various places around the world. How did you end up here in Bisbee?
You know, it was kind of just chance. You know, I was in Tucson from 96 to 2000. Right there, like in the barrio, you know, on Convent and Kennedy, kind of. And I was writing this book, Fools Rush In, and I was having a really hard time concentrating in Tucson. For some reason, the barrio became very small. And so I started renting a little house here, really cheap. And I didn't know anybody here. I didn't know one person. And somehow that worked because I didn't have any outside distractions. And it stayed that way for several months where I didn't know anybody. I ran the hills and walked and thought and read. And I'd go do some work somewhere in California because I work in the film business. I can do some work. And then I come back and write. And I just did that for like 2 or 3 years. And it worked. You know?
So you wrote the bulk of Fools Rush In here in Bisbee?
Here and then up in Northern California, like in near Mendocino, in a place called Comanche. Mm-hmm. It's like in the woods. So between here and there, that was pretty much the bulk of it.
For the listeners who haven't read your book, why don't you just give a little synopsis of it?
A Fool's Rush In?
A Fool's Rush In, yes.
I always find that a bit difficult.
Difficult to do, I'm sure.
I mean, the synopsis, some people want to say it's a war, you know, it's a book about war, but I think people who read the book realize it's nothing, it's the theater. There's a lot of war in the book, but it's strictly the theater, the background. The book's coming from my angle. It's, you know, I'm telling you the story, but it's kind of it begins at a time when I had a radical emotional earthquake in my life, of loss of a fiance, and it kind of set me on a massive journey of grief. And 2 years into that journey of grief, I landed myself in Croatia during the Bosnian War. And I really didn't know what I was doing. I didn't even know what really was going on in detail. I just knew that I wanted to do something. Because, you know, grief has a strange, it's a very strange animal. You know, it really wants you to, you don't know what to do, except for, in this case, I wanted to give. Because somehow it feels like that's the right thing to do. I think it has to do with love. If you're in love with someone and they die, you still have the love, but you have no recipient. So then all of a sudden, you know, you're looking for something to do with it. So for me, I got over there and I started to work humanitarian aid. And the book really kind of takes off there. Because I met these clowns, literally a circus, and we delivered food in Sarajevo and Bosnia during the war, in the middle of the war, in the height of the war, which was totally insane, dressed as clowns and delivering food, which was, it's very surreal, it's very hard, it's very black humor, and it's very hard to imagine, but it happened, you know. And of course, there's a bigger story after that. Good God, the book takes off, and I do things that I never thought I could do.
I remember the your living situation. You were in a large high-rise, I believe.
Yeah.
And describe that a little bit. That fascinates me.
The high-rise is it's called the Unis Tower. It's the largest building in Sarajevo. There's two towers, like twin towers. They're twin towers, you know?
Oh, my gosh.
It was completely burned top to bottom. But the first seven floors of one of the towers was kind of used by various humanitarian organizations. The army press was there for the Bosnian army. And we took the seventh floor, which really was completely gutted, trash, burned, you know. It was a travel office, and so we just took it over and made it into our home, and we kind of built a sniper protection zone for ourselves so they couldn't see us. We built a ping pong table out of some wood, and we slept on the floor, sleeping bags, and our trucks were in the basement under a gate, you know, locked, because otherwise just everything's robbed immediately, of course. So that's where we lived. But we had to get water. I mean, every single day, you know, when you're in a place like Sarajevo in a war, it's hard to really comprehend. Tucson's not a good example because Tucson's so spread out. But like maybe San Francisco or a town that has limits by geographical borders.
Sure.
And then imagine 500,000 people with, there's no water, there's no electricity, there's no sewer, and there's no food. Well, that may be okay for like a week. Not okay, but, you know, doable. A month maybe. But for 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, you know, if you just try to imagine, what do people do for 4 years with sewer? You know what I mean? And it becomes, if you can smell my book, it would smell bad. But at the same time, I met these amazing people there.
And
so full of life.
People, snipers in the hills.
Yeah.
Right? Because Sarajevo is
in a little
valley.
Yes, like a mountain valley.
So there were people, I'm assuming, with binoculars or whatever. With some way of looking for movement, for
anybody.
People.
It doesn't matter who you were.
It
doesn't matter if you're local, international. They don't care who you were. And where we were was almost the closest you were to the front lines in that town. The town was like an oval, the safe part. But in the middle of the oval, there was a real big indentation. And we lived right on the edge of that. And that was, you know, we were like 150 meters. So that's pretty close. So our building was quite often bombed heavily for days at a time.
Why did you choose such an exposed spot?
Well, it wasn't really that we chose it. There's nowhere else to go. I mean, it was a building that had a basement for the trucks. It allowed us to stay there because, you know, even in the middle of that kind of situation, there's still someone running that building who says you can stay or can't. And they let us stay there. I mean, there's not many places you can stay in Sarajevo in a war. So with trucks and with, you know, all that kind of stuff. So we just kind of had to do it, you know. We didn't really have a choice. But it worked out. I mean, you know, kind of.
There may be some similarities with what's happening in Gaza right now, where you've got an urban environment and a people under siege and under duress.
Right. When Gaza started going down this last week, the similarities are that you have a massive civilian population that is not quite sure where to run, where to hide, what to do. They're probably, at this moment, cut off from everything, any outside world, probably food, probably everything. Everything is cut off. This isn't really discussing, I'm not really talking about whether you're, you know, the Israeli army or the Hamas militants. I'm talking about like the massive population of people. They're just screwed. And many of them are going to die because they don't know where to go. And if they walk in the street at the wrong time, they die. It's a little bit like that. The difference is that the sustainability, that will be, something will happen in the world to bring that to a ceasefire. Maybe a crappy ceasefire, but something's going to happen because it's too public a war, you know what I mean, for the world. But Sarajevo went under the radar, kind of. It was in the papers, but no one did anything about it for years. So, which made it the longest siege in human history that we know of. You know, maybe there was something that happened in BC, you know, Romans or whatever, that we don't know about. But and very, very violent. I think that the, not that the Israeli Hamas thing is not violent, but I think it will have a short, finite, this level, this heightened level will be short. And Syria was, you know, just brutal, brutal for years, you know.
I read your book several years ago.
Right.
But I still have images in my mind, and one is of the young couple that were caught, that were shot and killed by sniper fire
right.
In a courtyard or in
right. Trying to leave. They were actually going to leave.
Right.
I think that's the one you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were leaving to go to. They were actually Serbians, and they just wanted to escape, and which is normal. You know, the city had all ethnic groups. The guys on the hill were all Serbs, but the people in town were Serbs, Croat, Muslim, Jewish. And they were shot because they were trying to escape, and you can't escape. So, but they stayed there for a long time. That was what made them kind of a symbol, because you can't retrieve people. If people are killed near the front line, nobody can go get them because they'll be killed as well. So it was very, you know, people just sit there for days and weeks until someone gets brave enough to do it in the middle of the night with no moon. They would wait for like the moon cycles, you know, really dark to go down there.
It seemed you described pathways, safe pathways,
right,
that were somehow shielded from sniper fire, except for perhaps narrow areas where
right.
you could run quickly through there.
Yeah, you know, the funny thing is I go back now. I was back in August, so, you know, 5 months ago. And I've been back many times, but the first time I went back after the war, and the town had reestablished roads and streetlights and whatnot, I was extremely confused because I did not know that town in the proper way, with a grid. You know, I had no clue where I was going. I got lost, and I felt like an idiot because I knew that town literally as a blind man. I mean, I had, you know what I mean? When you live in that kind of place, you quite often do it in complete pitch black so that no one can see you. So I knew how to get around that whole town literally by Braille. But only in these back alleys, through this person's basement, through this yard, through that hole in the wall, through that tunnel, back through this burned out factory. Da, 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 da. It was, you know, miles and miles of secret tunnels, secret passages. And then all of a sudden I'm like, wow, I don't know how to get to that person's house anymore because I have to be on the road. And phone numbers. You know, no one ever exchanged phone numbers for 4 years. So when I got to town, when I used to go to town, I would get off like the UN airplane or something, get into town, and walk to my friends. Well, now I didn't know how to walk to my friends, and I didn't know how to call them because I didn't know their phone number. So it took me a little while to figure it all out.
The other thing I remember is that you made friends with, was it two sisters?
Yeah, Layla and Selma.
And you described going to their place through some of these, you know, little passageways and all that.
Yeah, they were the first people I met. When I got there, I really thought that we were with the circus. We were doing our thing. We were delivering food and blowing fire and juggling. But they were the departure to change everything. Because when I met them, which was totally random, I was standing guarding our Jeep from being pillaged by a bunch of kids while some guys made a delivery. And I met these two girls who asked me to go to lunch. Now, that's an odd thing to ask someone in the middle of that place. Because no one has any food, one. And the way they asked was very casual. But I went with them, and, man, to get to their house, you had to go right across what was called Sniper's Alley, which was a death trap. And then you go through, and I went with them. Then you had to go through a series of tunnels that their family had created to escape. And I had the best time. For 4 hours, I sat there, and, you know, we had, like, a spring onion each, and maybe a little rice, but we laughed and they told stories and they had a certain lightness to them that made me connect for the first time. Because when you're delivering food and stuff, you're just delivering and driving away. And all of a sudden I realized that I couldn't leave because these people were amazing. These two sisters were fantastic. So suddenly I realized I had to figure out some other way to stay here. And that kind of started me being much more involved. you know, there's a scale that happens in that place like that. If you go, if you stay too long, you go crazy or you die. If you don't invest enough time, you feel like you didn't do enough, which then is kind of the other side of that is survivor's guilt happens. There's a, you know, it becomes a real mess. So you kind of have to make a decision about what you're going to do. You know,
one of the things you did was you, okay, you have a city under siege that is cut off from the world,
right.
But you established a satellite link with U2,
right.
With the band U2. Talk about that.
That was one of my crazier ideas. It all really began with I watched U2. Someone had a generator, and we were watching MTV. And I saw U2 talking. And you know, U2 has, this is back in 93. And I know U2 has, you know, they're Irish, they have their own history of a war with religion being used as a false front, which most of the time they always are. And so I just thought they would be good. I didn't really have I just thought they'd be good people to represent the outside world in music. And the idea was small. The idea was to reach out and ask them to tape a message. Because I was hanging out with a lot of musicians. By this time, I was there for months now. And by this time, I was hanging out with musicians and poets and writers and just really amazing people. So I thought I just would tape Bono saying something. Because to bring back like a message from the outside. Because remember, these people have been cut off. So the idea was just to give like a small message. Like, hang in there, we're here, and that kind of, you know, that's simple, but something like that. So I wrote U2 as if I was the editor of the television station in Bosnia, because I knew they wouldn't listen to it like a civilian. And they answered and said, yeah, we'll do an interview with the television editor of Bosnia. And then, of course, I had to rewrite the thing to say, well, we can't come out because we'll be killed at the front line, but our foreign associate, Bill Carter, can. So that's how I got in. And so I went to Verona and met the band, and it was phenomenal. Right from the very beginning, it's an amazing interview, and he was very curious how I got in, because he realized that, of course, I was not Bosnian. And they, right after the concert, they were very, very clear about, we hung out, and they like wanted to do something. They wanted to help right then, right now. But that was complex. And I told them, really, it's not, if I ask you for $100 million, it would all go to waste. It's not about money. It's a bigger thing. We need to figure out how to change the channel here. And I think that intrigued them. And it was a challenge. And they said to me, you have a couple days to figure something out, and we'll do it. So think about it. And then I thought, and of course they wanted to come to Sarajevo, but they couldn't come because everybody would die, because you know, more than 10 people in a spot is a target. So what I did is thought, well, why don't we just bring Sarajevo to U2. And so they have these big televisions and satellite, and it was the you know, kind of the Zeuropa tour, where they were making a big deal about technology. So they agreed immediately. And I think about it today, they were phenomenal. We spoke to millions of people. We'd go live from Sarajevo to the middle of a concert, shut the concert down, and do a live 10-minute feed. And I would bring in people that, like friends or people I met. And I think about it, and I've talked to Bono since. They met me for maybe 3 hours. And then they trusted me in front of 60,000 to 70,000 people. I mean, I could have been crazy. I could have said anything, you know. But it went amazing. The people from Sarajevo were very gracious, and they weren't mad, and that was the big deal. I told them, don't get mad at the people you're going to talk to, because these are your potential allies. These are your friends. These are young people. You know, these are the people that maybe don't like their politicians either. So talk to them like they're people that you could sit down with one day, as opposed to be angry at Europe, which is that was inside of them. They were angry at Europe. But I told them don't do that, because there's no victory there, you know. Anyway, so it went really well. And And then you two asked me, they knew I was filming too. By this time I was making a lot of footage, which would then become this series. I had no idea what it would become. I was clueless. I was just documenting footage. And then they brought me to Ireland and put me in the studio for probably about a month, and it came out with Miss Sarajevo.
So Miss Sarajevo is your documentary film.
Yeah, right.
About your experience there and the footage that you took.
But again, it's kind of like when you asked me about the book, I think Miss Sarajevo and Fools Rush In are very similar in the sense that if I hand it to someone, they think, oh gosh, it's going to be heavy. I don't know if I can read that. Or watch that. And then when people do, it quite often has a much deeper effect on them, which isn't, and maybe yes, there's some heavy stuff in there, but there's also like this, but believe me, I'm not crediting myself, it's the people that I met, the people that are, the characters in the book and the people in Miss Sarajevo have an incredible, I mean, I don't want to steal a great author's title, but it's the unbearable lightness of being. They have this incredible radiance about them that is mesmerizing, because you can't help but imagine, what would you be like in that situation? If I could be like the little girl Alma, I would be a hero, you know, in my own, like, meaning means I'd survived. So I think that is what happens, is people are very affected by it. I've shown that movie all over the world, and the effect of it is huge. It's really amazing. I'm quite shocked.
Now, you're going back to Sarajevo soon. Tell me more about that.
I go in April, April 6th. It's actually called Sarajevo Day. It's like it's their day of celebration for their city. But they've decided to give me honorary citizenship, and that's the day they've chosen. So I'll be going there to put on my fancy suits, and it's a very formal setting with lots of diplomats and politicians, and to receive this honorary citizenship, which is, you know, totally blown me away, because I don't know, it's a huge honor.
I came upon your book, Fools Rush In, through music. It was, I became interested, this is maybe 4 years ago.
Right.
I became interested in local music in Tucson, and I went to the Calexico website.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was John Convertino who had read your book and recommended it, and maybe even wrote a little review or something.
Yeah, he wrote a little blurb for
it. Yeah, a little blurb on the Calexico website. And so I went out and bought it,
right,
the book, and read it, and was fascinated by it.
Yeah.
Still am.
Yeah, that's exactly when it came out. And, you know, John and Joe, we're all good friends, and we've known each other for a long time. And I was working on their photography from the beginning of when they were Calexico, or, you know, before their Calexico, when they were still with Giant Sand. I was doing all that stuff.
Here I am in Bisbee with Bill Carter. I'm Dr. Dan Twelker, working for KXCI, 91.3 FM KXCI. And we're just chatting. We're talking about the books you've written, Fools Rush In, Red Summer. We're talking about Tucson and Southern Arizona music, and about the world.